Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our official website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the link to become a Patreon donor. We appreciate it. All right, welcome to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's podcast, we have an interview with one of my good friends, Roger Schwab. Roger was the head judge with the IFBB in the late 1970s, early 1980s. We've had him on the show a couple times, but believe it or not, it's been about 2 years since we've talked to Roger. So it was good to talk to him again after the pandemic now is over. And my reason for talking to Roger was I thought we would revisit some of the great articles that Roger wrote for Iron Man magazine. In addition to being a judge, Roger also wrote some really good contest reports for the old Iron Man magazine published by Perry Rader. And he also wrote the very first issue of Iron Man that when it was owned by John Bailick, he wrote the Mr. Olympia report for that year also, which was 1986. So I thought it'd be fun to have Roger back on the show, and I brought the articles with me during our interview. And I'm sort of quoting some of these articles as I'm talking to him and getting his thoughts and opinions on those competitions. So we're going to talk about the 1977 Mr. Olympia, the 1978 Mr. Olympia, and the 1979 Mr. Olympia. Those were the three contests that Frank Zane won. And Roger wrote the contest, the Mr. Olympia contest reports for Iron Man magazine for all three of those shows. And then we're going to talk about the 1986 Mr. Olympia, which was the third Mr. Olympia won by Lee Haney. And as I mentioned, Roger also wrote the contest report for that, which was, I believe, in the March issue of 1987 of Iron Man magazine. And that was, as I said, the first issue published by John Bailick after he bought the magazine from Perry Rader. So we got Roger's interview coming up in a second. Before we get to that, I got some emails I want to read. So thank you guys for sending me these emails. If anyone out there wants to send an email on this show or any thoughts or comments you have on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, you can do it by sending them to naturalolympia@gmail.com. What else is going on? I went to my friend Tim Gardner's birthday party over the weekend. His wife Eileen had a surprise birthday party for Tim. It was his 60th. So that was good. It's good to see Tim. Tim is one of the top promoters in the IFBB. He promotes the Tampa Pro Show every August out here in Tampa. And he also promotes many other shows, including the Puerto Rican Pro. And he's one of the top promoters in the IFBB, and he's an IFBB judge. He's been around the industry a long time. So I got to see his beautiful new house, and it was great to see Tim and to celebrate with him. So happy birthday to Tim, Big 6-0. I'm right behind him. I'll be there next year. Rich Gaspari's birthday is today on the 16th, the 16th of May. Rich is also 59, the same as me. So he will be 60 next year also. So it was great having Rich on last week on the podcast along with Lee Haney and Samir Banood. I hope you guys enjoyed that podcast. I just put the video interview of that podcast up on YouTube. I just put it up this weekend, and it's getting a lot of views. A lot of good comments. People really liked it. Of course, how can you not like an interview with Lee Haney, Rich Gaspari, and Samir Banood? And they were, of course, talking about Eddie Giuliani, who passed away. And they were also talking about World's Gym, the atmosphere that they had out there, and just the old days of bodybuilding and sort of how bodybuilding's changed also. And the longevity of the old school bodybuilders is definitely different than the guys today, unfortunately. I want to wish my brother Don and his wife Jenny a happy anniversary. They celebrated their 30th wedding anniversary just this last weekend. So happy anniversary to my brother and his wife. 30 years. Wow. 1992. I can remember that wedding like it was last week. But man, what an achievement. What a monumental achievement. They have two sons. who are both out of college and they're both doing great. So great family and great achievement. A lot of great memories of their marriage over the last 30 years. And here's to many, many more. All right. Let me read some of these emails before we get to our interview with Roger Schwab. This one comes from Canada. It says, "Hey, John, I've really enjoyed your books and podcasts over the last few years when you began the podcast. I think weight training is fantastic, and I believe this is where the mix of lifting weights and cardio can keep one fit and perhaps shape their body to what they want. Of course, a good diet is a big piece of that. I find current bodybuilding a sad affair as the physiques are not aspirational but rather cautionary, as the substance used for such looks is not healthy, safe, sustainable, and aesthetically pleasing and will kill the sport. I think testing is something they should have maintained as they tried it in 1990. It's really a sad situation when so many bodybuilders are dying at relatively young ages. I think your program reaches back to celebrate natural physiques, or at least relatively more natural than now. Natural bodybuilding, which you have excelled at in the highest levels and I respect, is sadly not in vogue to the degree that it should be. I enjoy the interviews, particularly when you chat regularly with Jerry Branum, which seems to be an honest discussion of the then and now. I have continued with weights for the last 25 years, and I have never suffered an injury. Safety first in lifting and just trying to keep healthy. I will continue to listen, and I'm very happy to see there is an audiobook to your excellent Bodybuilding Legends book, which I have really enjoyed reading. Health is wealth. Happiness comes from pursuing our passions. Regards, S from Vancouver, Canada." All right. Thank you for that email. Yeah, I love talking to Jerry as well. And we will have him on the show again soon, I'm sure. But good for you. Training for 25 years. That's great. And you are healthy and no injuries. That's awesome. So thank you for that email. This one says, "Hey, John, your most recent episode was both entertaining and a good conversation about all of us understanding how to maintain health with diet, nutrition, and exercise. It's a good message, and hopefully people are exercising to feel good and increase the quality of one's life. Development of the self inside and out is the key. Obsession with the outer body to the cost of one's mind and spirit is the road to ego-driven foolishness. Health is wealth. Happiness is finding one's purpose. Any plans to speak with Bill Pearl?" From what I understand, Bill has Parkinson's disease now, and from what I've heard, he is not doing any interviews at all, which I can understand. But as we mentioned last week on the podcast, Samir mentioned it, Bill had an accident driving a lawnmower, and I think he fell kind of on his head because the thing tipped over. But I think he's doing pretty good. I've read his wife, Judy, has been listing his updates on Facebook, and he seems like he's doing okay. So thank God for that. Bill will be 92 this October 31st. He was born in 1930. So thank God for Bill Pearl, and I hope he lives a long life. He has lived a lot longer than many of the champions he competed with. So I hope he keeps going strong. He's a great guy. And I got one more email here from Dan. It says, "Hey, John, first, thanks for your podcast. It's one of my favorites. I love the interviews you do. Your honesty and getting to the facts as best you can is key for me. Keep up the great interviews. Also, I've thoroughly benefited from your MP6 book. I bought it just this last August in 2021, and I've been following it since then. I've had solid results from it. I've been working out with weights since 1982, so I know how to follow the bodybuilding magazines, and I do various workouts from the beginning, and I've worked out faithfully since 1982 with weights. But I never knew how to train with weights. That's the key difference, how to train with weights, not just work out. So thanks, John, for the MP6 book. I think it's a fabulous book. It includes pretty much what anyone needs to know in regards how to train with weights for the growth and strength and mass. Just two questions. I do have many. First, during your deload week, when you're doing approximately 50% less, how much time do you rest between sets? And second, have you ever trained consistently with chains or bands with certain exercises when following your MP6 program? And if so, your thoughts and results. Again, thanks as always, John, Dan." All right. Thank you, Dan. I'm glad you enjoyed that book. With the deload week, for those that don't know, is after I finish a cycle, which is usually 6 weeks, and that's why I call it the MP6 workout. mass power, and six stands for 6 week cycles. So I do a power cycle that lasts 6 weeks, and then I'll do a mass cycle that lasts 6 weeks. After each cycle, I'll do what they call a deload week, where basically it's almost like a week off. I will use 50% of the weight I normally use. So if I'm benching, let's say 250 pounds, I'll just bench 125 pounds and I'll just do like 10 to 12 reps. It's almost, like I said, like a week off. So the question is, how much do I rest in between sets? Not much. Obviously it's very lightweight, but it's just to give the body a rest. It's just to deload, as it says. So I'm not trying to make the workout intense at all. I'm just doing lightweights, going through the motions, basically. Just, I go slow with the movements, just feeling the muscles working. And it's almost like an active rest. I'm not really training to tear down the muscle tissue because the weight is so light and the intensity is very low. So I'm just kind of going through the workouts with lightweights and just to give my body and my mind a rest. So that's the answer to your question. It's not much rest at all. Maybe a minute and a half, depending if I'm training with a partner or not. With the bands and chains, no, I really haven't used much with that. I still use mostly free weights, barbells, dumbbells. I see a lot of people in the gym using the bands. One exercise that I would like to use it with would be the hack squats, because they say it's much easier on your knees when using the bands. And I see people using that, and it kind of takes the tension off the knees when you get to the bottom of the movement, and you can use a lot more weight. So, but I don't know much about it, to be honest with you. I haven't really experimented with them, and I've never really used them. Same thing with the chains. The chains obviously add more weight. And if you're using the chains that are long enough to hit the floor, for example, like on the bench press, you're going to increase your acceleration power because the weight is increasing the more you press the weight up, because then you're using more of the chains as you're coming up. So those are both good, and want to try that, you should. But I haven't had much experience with it, to be honest. But I would like to. I'm open to it for sure. Okay, that's all I got for emails. I do want to mention, after our interview with Roger is over, I'm going to read an article. It's actually one of the articles we refer to in our interview. It is the 1978 Mr. Olympia contest report, which I was at that contest when I was 15 years old. And it was one of my favorite Mr. Olympias that I saw. That was the one that Cal Scalak competed in, and he did the infamous crucifix pose. So we do talk about it in the interview, but I'm going to read the full article when we get done with our interview with Roger Schwab. And this comes from the January 1979 issue of Iron Man magazine, and this was the Iron Man that was published by Perry Rader. All right, without any further ado, here is our interview with former head judge of the IFBB, Roger Schwab. Here we go. All right, welcome to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest with me today, my friend Roger Schwab, who was one of the head judges of the IFBB in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And he was also a great writer. He wrote a lot of articles for Iron Man magazine about the Mr. Olympia, and that's what we want to talk about today. So, Roger, welcome to the show. It's good to see you again.
Good to be with you again, John.
Well, I'm sure you heard about the passing of Eddie Giuliani yesterday, huh?
You know, he was one of the really good guys.
Yeah.
Giuliani was no attitude. He was just nice to everybody. He had a just the greatest of guys, but he lived a pretty good, long, healthy life. He was really a mainstay of the golden era.
Yeah. Yeah, he lived to 87, so he lived a long life.
Yeah. He's a great bodybuilder. People don't realize, you know, he was a very muscular guy. He was short, but he was always competitive. Whenever he entered something, you could be pretty sure he would be in really good shape.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think a lot of people saw him as like the manager of World's Gym and, you know, one of the mainstays of that crowd with Arnold and Joe Gold and those, and Szabo. But they forget that he had a great competitive career starting at a pretty young age too, right?
Right. He lived, and, you know, he lived a healthy life. He was competitive. He always looked good. He never looked bloated.
Right.
You know, muscular, strong looking. He was the way, you know, that you wanted bodybuilders to look.
Yeah, yeah.
He had that craziness. He had a look that, you know, gee, if I train hard enough, I might not look like him, but he's a good person to look to.
Yeah, yeah. And he was right up there with Danny Padilla at the 77 Mr. America, you know?
He was good. You know, I met him in the early 70s, And it was really interesting because I mentioned to him about the first, it's a good anecdotal thing. I mentioned to him when the first time I met him, Eddie, I said, you make sure that when you're not on the stage, when you're in the wings, that you keep your thighs flexed and your abs flexed. Because yeah. The last time I saw you, you relaxed there and judges look, and they don't only look at the competitor who's posing. They'll look into the wings and they want to see that you're really sharp. Now, he knew me from Adam. He didn't know me at all. Mm-hmm. From that moment on, there was definitely a mutual respect. And he always looked to me. And I really liked him. I really liked him, especially the time he jumped into Arnold's arms during.
Yeah, right. And you were right there. You walked in with those guys, right?
In fact, yeah, I walked in with Arnold that day. And the first thing that happened was Arnold walked in. And it was really unstaged. Eddie just
was unstaged,
jumped into his arms.
Yeah, you could tell it was improv, like it wasn't staged because Arnold was like surprised when he did it, you know. Yeah, you could tell he was a good person because I was reading all these things on Facebook yesterday where people were talking about him and everybody had good things to say about him, you know. So you could tell you lived a good life when people always have positive things to say about you.
Yeah. He's very close to John Bailick, and John Bailick just couldn't say enough good things about it. And
yeah.
He had his time at Gold's and especially his time at World Gym.
Yeah. Yeah, I met Eddie 4 years ago. I went out to Gold's Gym in 2018, and I was training with Phil Williams. Remember Phil Williams? And Phil wants to train at 5 in the morning, so we had to go to the gym at 5 in the morning, and Eddie was there early in the morning. So I asked him to do an interview on my podcast, and he goes, what's a podcast? He had no idea.
He's like me. He's one of these old dogs, you know, who
is yeah.
Magically challenged.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Roger. Well, I want to talk about some of these Mr. Olympia competitions that you were there. What was the first Mr. Olympia you saw? Do you remember?
The first Mr. Olympia I saw was 1965. I mean, the first.
Mr. Oh, the first one. The very first one. Wow. Which,
you know, some ways was the most exciting one.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
You really had to see. Well, the early 60s were Larry Scott. In 1962, he won the Mr. America contest. IFBB in 63, right after Harold Poole got beat in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania by Vern Weaver for the AAU Mr. Murphy, he jumped organizations and he switched to the IFBB. And I guess Weider thought that it'd be a great competition and would draw fans if both of them competed against each other.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought that Harold would have jumped to the IFBB and competed in the Mr. America, but he went right into the Mr. Universe, and he beat Larry Scott in 1963. It was a real eye-opener.
Wow.
So Scott came back the next year and won the Universe, but in 65, the first Mr. Olympia contest, that was, to me, that was the height of Larry Scott's career. He won the next year in 66, but in 65, you were just a kid, John. You probably don't even remember, but he was so good.
Yeah.
You just couldn't believe when Larry Scott walked out and the fans in the Brooklyn Academy of Music, who could be really loud when they wanted to, they went nuts over him. Shoulders and arms. And I remember he just looked really, really great.
Yeah.
You tended to overlook how good his legs were. But his thighs and his calves were very, very muscular, right up there with his upper body. And, of course, he had this golden tan that you never saw before or probably ever again on a person. And he was just the epitome of the California bodybuilder.
Yeah, wow.
Wonderful. So that was the first one. Then I saw 66, and I remember 66 was more competitors. I got a chance to meet Chuck Sipes, which was really a highlight of my young life at the time. And Draper was there and just tremendous contest. And Szabo was there. I mean, really, he competed in another contest that night, but it was really, really great. And then they started to, you know, then the next great one was 72, I think, 72 in Essen.
Yeah.
That was Olympia, you know, they still talk about it today and justifiably so. I mean, you had Newbray, and Oliva and Franco and Arnold and Zane in the same competition.
Think about it. I know.
You love this sport. You had to love us in Germany in 72.
Yeah. Did you see Arnold win in like 73, 74 when he was at his peak?
Yeah, I saw him both years.
Both of them. Wow. That's amazing. And
I mentioned in print that unfortunately I said to Arnold, I think that your best shape was 73.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like that one bit. And you know, and if you look at the pictures, he was right and I was wrong. He was best in 74.
Right.
That picture, there's an iconic picture of him walking up to the, on the stage.
Yeah, on the stairs, yeah.
You've seen it. He was really, really at the epitome of his physique.
Yeah.
Bigger than ever that year, and he was sharper than ever that year.
Now, that was all the way back in 1974, so that's almost 50 years ago, right? And now,
still
his physique, even today, 50 years later, his physique still stands out, right?
Well, you know, I'm the wrong person to talk to about 2020s. To me, this was the era. It all changed in the mid-90s, but 74, even 75 in South Africa, he was a little bit leaner, but very, very, very sharp, very good.
Yeah.
I mean, these were great years. I mean, he was the greatest bodybuilder ever.
Yeah, I agree. I was talking to somebody at the gym the other day, and they said, you know, Arnold, if he competed today, would have a hard time winning a state-level contest. I'm like, are we talking about the same Arnold? Have you seen how he looked in 74 and 73? And like you said, even 75? I mean, there's no way. His physique was unbelievable.
Yep, and he probably should have stopped there. But, you know, I wasn't in Sydney in 1980.
Yeah.
I've seen the pictures like everybody else. That could have gone to, you know, the great thing about Sydney in 1980 was that there was so many guys showed up in such tremendous condition.
Yeah, I know.
Any one of the first six or seven or eight could really have been declared the winner.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was Arnold, and I guess Arnold's maturity outweighed the great muscularity of the other guys, but pictures don't do him justice in that context, especially his legs, which didn't look nearly as trained as they had in previous years.
Yeah.
But he won, and I wasn't there, so I just, you know, I preface everything I say about it. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I heard what Boyer said and what Menzer said and what Zane and Dickerson and Callender and Roger Walker said. None of them were very happy. Or Dennis Marino.
Yeah. Now, if you would have went, Roger, would you have been an actual judge, or would you have been the head judge?
I was the head judge of the IFBB.
Okay.
I accused myself. To me, as a matter of integrity, I had trained with Mike Menzer in July and August of 1980. Mike lived in Ephrata, PA, which was near York, which was a about an hour and a half drive from Bryn Mawr, where my gym was.
Okay.
Whenever Menzer was in, you know, in the state, he would always come to Mainline and train with us. Everybody on the staff and all the members knew him, and he was very accessible. But he trained that summer at our club, and he was definitely in the best shape I'd ever seen him in. And I wrote a letter to Ben Weider and Oscar State saying, I'll go and I'll cover it. But I don't think it's fair if I judge it. I'm just too close with him right now, and I don't think it would be fair.
Yeah.
In retrospect, the history of bodybuilding probably would have changed if I was there.
Hmm. Just as the head judge. So you would have been on stage.
I would have been a voting judge that year.
Oh, you would have been a voting judge. Yeah.
Because Paul Graham ran the contest, and he would have been those decisions. And in 1981, oh my gosh, I don't even want to go there, but I was the head judge of that contest. I'm not voting head judge, but that was Oscar State's and my decision, because in 1981, the decision was that I would be up on stage with the competitors on stage while they went through their compulsory poses.
Yeah.
I would put a word into each of their ears about, you know, what I knew all their physiques backwards and forwards. And I would say, make sure you do this, make sure you do that. Mm. And then I would tell them the poses. But I wasn't a judge that year, a voting judge, and it's just as well. But if I had been, again, I think the history of bodybuilding would have changed. So there's 2 years that this one guy in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania at the time could have changed the history of bodybuilding.
Right, right.
And I don't lose sleep over it, but I will tell you that I've thought about it.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of times.
Yeah, it's amazing. Even one judge would have made a difference, right? Well, it was that close with both Arnold and Franco winning in 80 and 81.
I could speak more frankly about 81 because I was there. But
yeah,
again, I think you and I have discussed it in the past. The point system, the way the IFBB set it up with Ben's desire to be recognized as a country, as a sport in the
yeah. United,
really screwed placing up in IFBB contests.
Yeah. It was
the same, you know, each competitor could get this. You could have 220s and 219s. A judge to do a job, everybody gets placed individually.
Yeah.
21-19, 118. And also in those years, these judges had to hold up their score sheets.
Like, oh, yeah.
The Olympics. They were intimidated.
Yeah.
It wasn't fair. And it was putting these guys, myself included, in a bad, bad position.
Yes.
Much better results on a placing system, 1 through 10.
Yes.
Simple, and it would have been done right, and you would have had much, much better decisions.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when we talk about the judging, too, when we talk about today's bodybuilders and how it is today, now they developed another category called classic physique because the bodybuilders with the good symmetry have kind of been pushed out of the way now because the guys are so big. And, you know, they say, well, that's, I just did a podcast the other day and they were saying, well, that's evolution. You know, that's the bodybuilders getting bigger is evolution. That's, but when you look at bodybuilding and from the era that you and I came from, it is an art and it's supposed to be judged on all the aspects of proportion and symmetry and the presentation is a big part of it, as well as muscle mass and definition. It's all of it together. And so that's why it intrigues me when I look back at those older contests, like the one that comes to mind right now is like 1982, where you had Frank Zane and Chris Dickerson, very aesthetic bodybuilders, and they were competing against Casey Viator, who was very big. Bertel Fox was in that contest. He's another mass monster. And then you had Muhammad McAway and Samir Banoot, who were smaller. But all of these guys were in one show. And the judges had to be intelligent enough and know what they were looking at, sophisticated enough to be able to judge all these aspects of the physique. And then he had the three rounds, which helped out. But it wasn't just who's the biggest and who's the hardest. It wasn't that easy. It was much more complicated than that.
You're definitely correct, except I was there in 1982.
Yeah.
I judged that contest. I had the results a little bit different, but it was a very hard contest to judge.
Yeah.
Well, when you mentioned Casey Viator, Casey had the potential to win more than one Mr. Olympia. He didn't win any Mr. Olympias. He never knew how to show his physique.
Yeah.
He was really Casey in 1971 when he won the Mr. America contest was actually quite a bit bigger than he was in 1982, these years later.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
The IFBB. He was sharper in the IFBB because as soon as he went to the IFBB, he realized in order to compete with the Zanes and the Banus and, like you said, in the Dickersons, he had to be sharper. And to me, he relinquished too much muscle.
Mm.
And he should have been who Casey could have been. That being said, Zane came in at 82, a little off, I'd say. He was showing his age just a little bit. Dickerson's elbows got everybody's attention. I don't know what was going on with those elbows, but and you don't judge a competitor on his elbows, obviously.
Right.
But it looked like it was either calcium deposits or growth hormone or whatever, but there was these two big golf size balls on the end of his elbows was hard to overlook.
Yeah.
The person who should have won that contest was Samir Banu. And he was a sharpie. And it was another poor decision on my part and the judging panel, because Banu had not paid his dues yet.
Mm-hmm.
He was the right, should have won the contest because he was in the best contest shape that day. Bertel was a second thought because Bertel had all the muscle in the world. Bertel had the muscle like in 2020, these big guys.
Yeah.
He could never quite get hard enough. I heard he was better in 83, and I wasn't there in 83, but he never really got to the definition that the IFBB seemed to require to win that contest. But
yeah,
he had hellish muscles.
Yeah. Freaky. Yeah.
Lower body. He had the whole thing.
Yeah. Do you think it was maybe Samir's presentation? I mean, not his closing routine necessarily, but just the way he conducted himself on stage, the prejudging, because I was watching the video of the prejudging of that contest. And even though he did probably have the best physique on stage that night, he wasn't really, he seemed like he was much more seasoned in 1983. Even 1 year later, he presented his physique much better.
And I think that you're right. And I think he would probably tell you that. I'm just saying, as far as the sharpest, hardest physique that
guy,
not the shape, it was Samir. Son of a gun. I had him fourth.
Did you really? Wow.
Yeah, it was a bad decision.
Yeah.
I had Zane, Dickerson, Casey, and Samir. I should have had Samir first, Dickerson or Zane and Casey 2, 3, and 4, whatever order.
Yeah.
I just had known Casey, and Casey was a friend of mine, and I had trained Casey, and he relinquished size to get sharp, and I think he would have looked better fuller. That's just
me. Yeah, yeah. That's amazing when you say that he was actually bigger in 1971 and 19 years old than he was when he was competing in the IFBB. He had to be something to see in 1971.
Yeah, you had to see Casey, but, you know, up close and personal. He was god-awful. That's, you know, he was a tremendous muscles, especially his limbs.
His forearms,
his bicep and tricep, his thighs, his calves, his pecs never really were tremendous. And his abs are, I mean, they're great, and his abs are great, but not at the highest level, I would say.
Yeah.
You and I have both seen pictures of Mike Mentzer with a head-on shot where he's just standing there without flexing.
Yeah.
To me, a friend of mine once said to me, who was the greater of the physiques, Mike or Casey? And I said, I thought that Casey was the greater of physiques, and I was wrong. Mike had the more finished physique.
Yeah.
Mike's skin tone was never what Casey, tremendous stretch marks all over, and
Real
didn't have the tautness of the skin that Casey had.
Yeah.
But as far as an overall symmetrical physique, I think. And people compare those two because they're built so similar, you know.
Like, yeah.
It was like, it wasn't like comparing Zane and Franco, but
yeah.
Mike and Casey were, and even Ray in that 1 year in 1979, the only year that Ray ever put it together, he was right there with those guys.
Wow. Yeah, Mike had to have a lot of respect for Casey, huh? Because he was in that America that Casey won, and they were the same age. They were both 19 years old at that time.
Exactly. They were friends, you know, pretty much throughout life.
Yeah.
They made one mistake. Casey moved to California in 1979 when he went to the IFBB, and the three of them, Mike told me by phone, you know, it was like him and it was Mike and Casey and Ray training together at Gold's Gym. And at the time, their egos, I think, got away from them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
They were really training. Very, very heavy partials, partial inclines, partial squats, just to see how much weight they could handle.
Yeah.
Mike had always had an injured shoulder, and his shoulder had problems almost immediately, and that experiment stopped, and they went back to more sensible training. But as far as I know from Casey, he never got hurt. his bones were, you know, his wrist must have been 8.5 inches. His wrists were the biggest I ever saw, with the possible exception of John Grimmick.
Wow.
Every time he shook my hand.
Yeah.
His wrists and his hands were like big old bear. And Kazmaier was another one who I met who had these gigantic wrists and hands.
Yeah.
You know, that goes back so far, John. I hope my memory is correct, but still to me, that golden era, it was so much fun being part of this. Mm-hmm. And there's so much camaraderie. And every month you're waiting for Iron Man and Muscle Builder to come out. And, you know, nobody, it was just either you're in that world or you were not in that world.
Yeah.
And then Rio Blair and his protein earlier in the 60s, and Larry Scott with the bleach blonde hair. It was just so cool to be part of that. Yeah. I don't think it's there anymore. And as far as you said earlier about these guys today and the classic physiques and the muscle monsters, I'm wondering what kind of lateral raises these big guys do that you must not have done to get those delts the way they look today, as compared to how ours looked, or even Don Howard, how great his delts were.
Yeah, yeah.
They must have a very special deltoid exercise to have those big cannonball shoulders.
Right.
Something else going on in there besides
Right, exactly, right. I'm reading Joe Gold's book right now, and he made a good point in there. And he was talking about the golden age of bodybuilding. And he said, now with social media, we have so much interaction with all these guys. You know, they have YouTube channels and they have Instagram. So they have to post stuff pretty much every day. He said, back in the day, before all the social media came around, we only saw them in the magazines, as you mentioned. So we only saw them once a month, and we never heard them talk. We never saw them. We never saw videos of them. So the only time you would actually see them is if you went to a contest or if you got to see them guest pose. And that's where I think the magic was, you know, because you never saw these guys. So it really was very, very special when you saw them in person. They had that aura like a movie star almost.
Isn't that a great point? No, that's something you never think about, but you're exactly right. It's when you got to the contest and you saw the names of the competitors, and, you know, and you said, oh, my gosh. We're going to get a chance to see these guys.
Yeah.
Heard about them.
Yeah.
Usually either New York or California or maybe in Chicago, but then you're never hearing about them once a month, just like you said.
Yeah. And
it created a mystique.
Yeah.
That mystique was really a great part of that era.
Yes. Yeah. I remember I was lucky enough to go see the 77, 78, 79 Olympias, and I was a teenager. I was 14 to 16 years old. And I remember just like walking around the lobby, and you would see Larry Scott, and you'd see Dave Draper, and you'd see Reg Park. And you'd even see like guys who weren't national competition winners, like Dave Mastorakis or Len Archenbault or somebody like that. And you'd see him in the crowd, and like, oh, I recognize him. I know who he is. And it was just so special. And then if you saw like Zane walking through or Arnold walking through, it was like, wow, you know, it was just amazing.
Yeah, it was. And they were approachable. And every one of the guys you mentioned were good guys. 77, 78, and 79, those three contests, the audience participation in that sleepy Midwest town of Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
They really came to life because they loved these guys. And they loved when Corny would pose or when Boyer Coase split his, you know, that right.
I said, yeah.
They knew these guys, and if you saw a silhouette before the contest of them, coming onto the stage, you knew who the guy was.
Right.
That was really special stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of that that you have these podcasts today, because people still love the aura of that era, which you really just don't see. It's just not there.
It's not there. No, it's changed. Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of those contests, Roger. Let me pull out this 86. It was actually the 87 issue of January 87 of that first Ironman. And you wrote about the Mr. Olympia that year. And I used to love your articles, Roger. I actually just wrote a letter to, I'm trying to get Jake Wood, who is the owner of the Mr. Olympia. I was asking him, I said, we should do a detailed Mr. Olympia report, you know, like you used to do. and like Rick Wayne used to do and Jack Neary used to do, you know, where he talks about every competitor and goes really into detail, because the way it is now, and again, this is because of social media, it's covered live, you know, it's broadcast live as a pay-per-view event, I guess. You can watch it on your computer or your phone. And as soon as it's over, everybody goes out into the lobby, and then there's all these different podcast YouTube channels, and, you know, they'll have like three or four people who will talk about it. And then that's it. It's over. And there's no recorded history of it, you know? Like if I go on Muscle Memory and I'll look at the 1969 Mr. America contest, on the bottom of the results, it says related articles. And you can go to an article that was in Iron Man or Muscular Development, and you could read all the details about the contest. And it's fun. If people do that 10 years from now about this year's contest, this year's Mr. Olympia, they won't find anything, because there's only like a quick report of the top 10, but there's no details like you guys used to do, you know?
That, to me, that was the fun of the whole thing, you know, writing the contest reports up. And oh my gosh, you know, we got tremendous feedback. I would get from Perry, I would get, you know, 100 letters.
Wow.
Not all of them that favorable, unfortunately, but for the most part, you know, there's only one winner. You know, there's only one winner. And you want to be as objective as possible, because it is your legacy and it is your dignity. And to tell everybody, well, everybody just looked great and everybody was this and that, you know, but it then, when you reread it, then what have I really said? So I made it a point after every contest that I judged to stay there after the contest. And I gained enough respect from these guys that they would talk to me and say, you know, how did you see it? And why did you see it this way? And I would really answer them. And I think for the most part, everybody walked away. If they didn't agree with me, they respected me. Greg DeFerro was a tough one. He was not crazy about the way I viewed his physique, which was really great. He was really good. But I referred to him as Rocky, and he didn't like that, because it was Rocky was an underdog at the time, and he didn't want to be looked at as an underdog. He thought he was a champ. But, you know, it was what it was. But I feel good about the fact that I was not only there, I said it how it was. They respected it. They respected me. I respected them. And it made my journey in this so much more meaningful than just being, you know, somebody who covered a contest who said everybody was great.
Yeah.
But yeah. Ricky Wayne, you know, I wasn't in his class. I mean, Ricky, God knows, he could lay it out there and he could really beat you up.
Jack, right.
Larry Bartlett, these were really good writers. I mean, we all had fun together. We were all friends, and coaching each other about our writings also, you know.
So
it was a camaraderie, John, and the bodybuilders and the writers and the judges, we all knew each other. There was some lousy decisions, but as I said many times, Joe Weider never influenced my votes. He never fixed any contest that I was in, apart from the idea that, as I've mentioned to you and in print, I didn't pick the judge. They wanted so much for this international recognition that they wanted a judge for from every country. That was a poor decision. There were some really great judges, and there were some poor judges, and they should have stuck with the great ones.
Yeah.
The biased ones, the objective ones. And we wouldn't have had the bad calls that we had during those times.
Yeah.
But saying as you were about Columbus in the upper 70s, they were magnificent contests and usually really, really good decisions.
Yeah. There really wasn't. Until we got to 1980 and 81, there really wasn't too many controversial decisions, you know. And you mentioned Joe, and what I was really impressed with, Luke, reading some of these old articles, like I just read or reread the 1981 Mr. Olympia report from Rick Wayne that was in Joe Weider's Muscle and Fitness magazine. And he was very, very critical of that contest. And Joe didn't edit that at all. They just let it go. You know, Rick wrote whatever he wanted to write, and they put it all in there. You know, and he was talking about Joe Weider. Then he was talking to Arnold. He had a lot of quotes about Arnold, where Arnold was saying, oh, Joe's an actor, and he acted like he was surprised about the contest. And I mean, I'm like, wow, this is really great reading. You know, it was great stuff to read, because it was really authentic and they didn't edit it all. They didn't water it down at all. So it was, I was impressed with Joe Weider that he put all that stuff out there. You could tell he was probably a real bodybuilding fan. You know, he wanted it all out there. He wanted everything in this magazine.
Well, there was no one like Ricky Wayne was totally thorough. Ricky Wayne wanted to get down to the truth about that 81 contest.
Yeah.
I'm at work one day and I got a call from Ricky right off the bat. He said, I want to know why this happened. And I want every freaking detail. And he wanted to publish that in his book, I think was Head and Shoulders Above the Rest, or one of the books he wrote about 1981. And look, I at that time I was smart enough that I documented everything that I did. So I documented my letter to Ben Weider saying, after 1980, we cannot afford to take a chance.
Yeah.
To have a decision so controversial that could bring down this federation. And he assured me. I wrote the same thing to Oscar State. But the strange thing was, John, at the competitors meeting before the contest, and you saw these seven judges from seven different countries, Oscar or I or one of the heads of this asked, are there any objections at all from the competitors? And there wasn't one. And
yeah.
somebody should have stood up and said, I don't know this person, or this person's from Italy. Does this person have any business dealings? Anybody in this contest? They weren't asked. In retrospect, maybe I should have said more than I did. But at least I documented it. It was enough that Ricky was satisfied, you know, that the contest was on the up and up and the chips fell where they may, which was the wrong way.
Yeah.
Frank didn't deserve to win that contest, and I think he knew it.
Yeah.
Arnold knew it, too.
Yeah. Remember, Arnold and Joe Weider didn't even come out on stage and hold up Franco's hand.
Oh, my God. It was pandemonium.
Yeah.
it was almost a riot.
I know. Yeah.
Before, the closest thing I ever saw to that was 1963 in the Zembo Mosque in Harrisburg when Vern Weaver beat Harold Poole in probably the worst decision in the history of bodybuilding.
Yeah.
There were chairs that were movable. People took those chairs and were throwing those chairs up.
No kidding. Wow.
It's cool. Of course, yeah. They didn't beat the Harold because he was 19. And the AAU at that time had never had a black Mr. America, besides the fact that I think he had a voice impediment, speaking impediment.
Yeah.
He should have won that contest so hands down, but he didn't. And so it was pandemonium.
Yeah. One of the things I loved about your articles when you wrote those Mr. Olympia reports was you would go back and talk about history. And this 1986 Olympia that I got from this Ironman magazine, you talked about how, first of all, how Haney was so dominant in the show. And you said nobody was that dominant until, and then you talked about, I got it right here. Yeah, you talked about the Zembo Mosque in Harrisburg when the AAU nearly sent bodybuilding to an early death with the colorblind decision rendering Vern Weaver Mr. America in 1963. And then you also talked about Sergio in 72, about how dominant he was, even though he lost the show. And then you also talked about Arnold in 73. And then you could also argue that Casey in 71, when he won the America, and Frank Zane in 78, when he won the Olympia, were also that dominant status where, like, very few people could, you know, no one would dispute the contest.
You know what brings to mind right now? And I think it was 19. What was the year that Tony Pearson won the Mr. America?
78.
So Tony Pearson, I think it was Cincinnati in 1978.
Yes.
And Tony Pearson was really muscular, won the contest. But in my opinion, who could have won the contest was the guest poser that night. Do you remember who it was?
Bill Pearl.
Right.
Wow.
You had to see it. This is Bill Pearl in 1978. And Pearl was born, I believe, in the 30s.
1930.
Okay, so he was, what was he, 45 years old or something like that?
48, yeah.
He comes out that night as the guest poser, and he was the best physique.
Wow, damn.
Just had to see him. I mean, growing up, when a guy in Philadelphia, John Fritchie, who owned the gym, used to have the Mr. Philadelphia contest, and he used to bring in bodybuilders. But one year he brought in Bill Pearl. And for a young kid who was wanted to get interested in bodybuilding, to see Bill Pearl in person perform, and he posed tremendously. But this was what bodybuilding should look like, in my opinion. Yeah. There was none of the vascularity that you see, there's none of that. It was none of the grainy look, maybe.
Yeah.
His abs weren't, they weren't Szabo's abs. It was a little bit like John Grimmick, if you ever saw John Grimmick.
Yeah.
Grimmick, people saw pictures. If you saw him in person, you had a different feeling about him than you did in pictures. He was that good. But Bill Pearl, in pictures and in person, you just had to see this man to believe how great he was. Yeah. Head and shoulders above the rest. And this night, guest posing in 1978, which was 7 years past his last Mr. Universe win.
Yeah.
He was the best man on stage that night.
Jeez, wow.
Isn't that great?
That's unbelievable. How did Bill Pearl pose, Roger? Like, you said, you know, obviously he's not doing anything flashy, but I heard, like, Boyer Crowe told me, he said, when you saw this guy on stage, it was unbelievable.
No twisting, no nothing. Just standing there looking like Hercules.
Yeah.
And you had to see his shoulders and pecs and quads and calves and arms, everything. Somebody once said he never won subdivisions. He never won subdivisions because every body part everything flowed together on Bill.
Yeah.
He was straight on poses. He had one pose with his arms up over the head like this, you know it, and his regular bicep pose. I never remember him ever doing front lat spread.
Yeah.
But he would do this tricep pose where those triceps of his were.
Yeah.
They were so good. Everything he did was just perfection, and he knew it. And he was strong, and he exuded strength also. It wasn't like the guy couldn't walk 10 feet without his thighs hit, you know, ruining his walk. He walked like a man. He was strong. He exuded strength. He bent bars, blew up hot water bottles. The man did it. The man had it all and did it all. He could have been, you know, it would have been very interesting, let's just say it, to see him and Arnold at their very, very best. I think that Arnold's muscularity in 74 would outweigh Pearl's maturity and magnificence in 71, but it would have been close.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been close.
That's one of the one contests that really should have happened, and I think we all regret that it never did. You know, Arnold and Pearl in 71, that would have been amazing.
And Oliva was there too. I mean,
yeah, that's right. That's right.
three very different physiques.
Yeah.
Would not, you know, I love being a judge. I would not have liked to have been a judge in that contest.
Yeah. Plus just the onstage interactions between all of them. I mean, it just would have been amazing, man. Unbelievable. So what did you think of Lee Haney going back to 86? You know, Lee had won now two Mr. Olympias before that, and this was his third. And, you know, I was at that contest too in 86, and he really was just so head and shoulders above the rest, right?
I think in that article, if I'm not mistaken, I wrote so many of them. I mentioned what Boyer Coe had stated.
That's the one.
If you have it in front of you, you could read it, because I think that that was, he said exactly the right thing, and Lee Haney transcended it that night.
Yeah. Yeah, he said he believed it was 1983 Olympia physique man Boyer Coe, who survived in the bodybuilding limelight for nearly 20 years, made an observation based on his experiences, and I will paraphrase, a problem with the trade magazines is that they create the illusion for the reader that the bodybuilding champion can and should make steady, if not spectacular, progress in a yearly basis. Coe stated further that realistically, this is not physiologically possible. And in this regard, Boyer is correct. But a strange thing happened on the way to the 86 Olympia. Someone did show undeniably remarkable improvement. And what's more, the man displaying this dramatic change was already unanimously recognized as the best bodybuilder in the world.
I think that says exactly.
Yeah. Lee was, I saw that contest, like I said, in 86. I saw him win a couple times. And, you know, and there were some great bodybuilders in that era in the 80s, you know, because the bodybuilders definitely stepped up from the 1970s. And, but Lee just had that V taper and, you know, that structure. And he was taller than most of the guys. And he just dominated. And he had that great stage presence as well, you know, that smile and everything. And, you know, he acted like a champion every time he won.
Yeah, and he had to be good because the smaller guys who were, he was competing against always seemingly came in very sharp.
Yeah.
Always looked good. Labrada never came in out of shape. Gasparri never came in out of shape. But Haney was in a league of his own.
Yeah, Gasparri was really good that year, too.
He was good every year. He was just
yeah.
Everything really, everything remarkably changed in 1993.
Yeah.
That was the year.
Yeah. Let me go back to 77, Roger, and we'll talk about that first Olympia that Zane won. And you wrote about this also in Iron Man magazine. And the contest talk before the show was that it was going to be Robbie because Robbie was looking unbelievable all year. And also Ferrigno was supposed to be one of the top guys, but Lou ended up not doing it because of the Hulk. So when you saw Zane on stage, were you expecting Zane to be the winner before the show? Or did you think Robbie was going to do it based on all the pre-contest hype?
I thought Robbie was going to win.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't have any doubt in my mind. All you had to do was look at Robbie do a front double biceps, and I think you can close the book.
Yeah.
He just, he was an enigma, Robbie. He was seemingly in better shape in the earlier parts of the year. And when October came, he just seemed a little bit off. And you can't come in a little bit off when Frank Zane is in the contest. You just can't.
Because
Zane would pose better. Zane was sharper. But Robbie, at his best, in 76 in Montreal, I think, or in early 77 when they were having the Grand Prix contest, I think that he could have won 77. It was very close. But Robbie, a little bit off, couldn't beat Zane, not off. And that's seemingly what happened throughout the 70s.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Zane would only compete, I think, in the Olympia.
Yeah, just the Olympia, yeah.
But Danny and Menser and Robbie had great contests amongst themselves at the Night of the Champions and those other Grand Prix contests, I guess they call them, or not, before the Olympia. But to answer your question again, I thought Robbie would win. And once he got on stage in the first moment, I knew he would.
Yeah. You talked about Zane, and you said Zane was the first to appear. He was number one that year, remember? Yeah, the number one.
He ran right out on stage, I remember, like yesterday.
Yeah. And he said, Zane possesses the flowing lines and shape of muscle, which immediately sets him apart from any other competitor. Tonight was the finest I've seen him. This man has been a champion since 1968 when he won the IFBB America. Every body part is a strong point. Tremendously detailed back and striated lumbar area. His legs, though not large, have nearly perfect shape and proportion. His posing routine, of course, is polished and displays the Zane physique to its apex. Most of his posing routine emphasizes his torso and abdominal development with arms away from the body or overhead. His presentation this night is ended with a clenched fist overhead. The pressure of the event weighed heavily upon Zane. He had seemed more hyper on stage this year than before. The usual calm Zane facade was but a surface for a cauldron of emotion just beneath. He knew this must be his year. And it was. And he did have the crowd behind him that year, too, I remember.
Yeah. I don't know what my words were about Robbie, but I bet you they are almost what we have discussed in the previous couple minutes, that he just, I could tell right away when Robbie came out, it wasn't going to be him. But Zane was at his best that year, up until that year. But he got better.
He got better.
And I think he reached his peak in 79. He should have retired then.
Yeah.
He could have been great. He could have, you know, I take that back. He could have been great in 80. He had that injury.
Yeah.
Around the pool or whatever it was that he got hurt. he was awfully good in 80. I mean, he was light with 10 pounds, but if you look at the pictures and the details, I mean, he was as sharp as he was in 79, maybe even sharper. He was just smaller.
And
he couldn't have been smaller that year in 80. But he, wow, man really knew how to put it together. When he called, they called him the chemist, he must have been.
Yeah, when he just stood to the front, he was like perfection. It's just the way his body flowed, you know.
Yeah, really. I mean,
yeah, about Robbie, you said Robbie was the first of the over 200-pound Olympia competitors. He was, of course, the pre-contest favorite and did not disappoint. Robbie was apparently heavier than I had seen him and nearly as sharp. A past criticism has been an absence of a personable, charismatic posing routine. Tonight, Robbie was a showman. There was no three or four poses and splitting the scene this night. This routine was longer, more creative and artistic than before. It did not take long for Robbie to know that the 77 Olympia was the fight of his life. Although Corny's posing had created a near riot, Robbie figured that the final confrontation would be between himself and Frank Zane. So it was that during the final pose-off at the Mr. Olympia contest, Robbie Robinson, in unprecedented style, evacuated his position in the center of the competitors and brushed his way next to Frank Zane. Here was the real battle of the night as each man posed with almost hyper-intensity.
That was the excitement of the night.
Yeah.
And he was disappointed that he lost, but I think that I just think he knew it. I don't think he was as good as he was in the previous year in Montreal, I think it was 76.
Yeah. Well, I think your onstage presence has a lot to do with it. And I remember one thing I was reading with Rick Wayne's article about the 81 Olympia was he said Danny was a little subdued in his presence. You know, he wasn't as aggressive as Tom Flats was or as Roy Callender was. And he figured that may be the reason why he didn't place as high. Because I think when people see pictures of that contest and they see Danny, they go, oh, he should have won. But they weren't there and they didn't see – you know, how he was on stage and what was going on with the prejudging, you know, and that's a big part of it.
Yeah, it is. But he was the best physique that night, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, give me a break. The guy was probably 160 pounds at the heaviest.
Yeah.
He was so little and he was so put together. There was just no weaknesses.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it was between him and Callender. You had he's another guy you just had to see in person.
Yeah.
How good he was.
Right.
He had it all. His calves were high. Yeah. But he was awfully, he was very, very good. He was great. Dickerson was Dickerson. You could always count on Dickerson for being in shape when he came to the contest, always throughout his whole career.
Yeah.
He was never off. It was just, did he have enough muscle to be Mr. Olympia? That's all.
Yeah.
And Platz was at his best that night.
Yeah. Right?
But did his upper body really stand with his lower body? I guess that night most people would have said yes, because I think in retrospect from what I've read over the years from the people who want to comment on that contest, they thought Platz should have been the winner of that contest.
Yeah.
I didn't think so. But and then it was all over for him because he tore his right bicep.
Yeah.
The next year. And that was the end of his really meaningful chance to win the Olympia.
Yeah. But he did have, and I was reading the 86 Olympia, he did have a great routine that night. And the crowd really connected with him. Remember that? Where, you know, it was at the end of his career. I think he retired 1 year later. But he really connected with the crowd that night in 86.
You know, as soon as he flexed his thighs and did, you know, what he did, he connects with that.
Right.
You know, but he was, you know, he kept on going. It was, you know, if you love that type of physique, you know, he was robbed, but in 81 at least, but he had his fans. He made enough money. I think he did great on the sport. He knew how to sell himself.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And he did it very, very successfully.
Yeah.
And not everybody knew how to do that, but he did.
But he
did? Yeah, he did. And he had courses and he was, you know, the Golden Eagle, and he had those, you know, those kids that everybody, you know, and you remember you saw the articles where he squatted 50 reps with some god awful weight or something.
Right,
like that.
Right.
And you looked at him and you believed it.
Yeah.
And people who I respected said he trained harder than anybody.
Yeah, I remember I saw a video of Tom, and this was in the 80s, and he said when he turned pro, he looked at his life and his career differently. He's like, now I'm a professional. I have to go on the road. I have to guest pose. I have to do seminars, you know. So he didn't look at, you know, like it was just competing. He knew that he was a professional. He looked at it differently.
Smart.
Yeah. 78 was also interesting, Roger, because you did an article again for Iron Man, and this was Zane's second win. And I want to read this paragraph here where it says, it was several minutes past 3:30 on this Saturday afternoon when announcer Len Boslin spoke to the anxious, overflowed audience. Ladies and gentlemen, the lightweight contestants in the 78 IFBB Mr. Olympia contest. And then he said, it is my gut feeling that within seconds of that announcement, an overwhelming percentage of the onlookers realized simultaneously that Frank Zane had defended his title spectacularly. Zane was the first to appear in the lineup, and it seemed endless seconds before the rest of the class followed him onto the stage. Zane nearly swept across the stage as if he were the only contestant. It was immediately evident that he was totally secure with his preparation. Realizing he was near or at total perfection of his development, Zane had seemingly already mentally projected himself as the winner. That's awesome.
Yeah.
He really was remarkably improved from the year before, and he always did have that mental attitude where you could tell he prepared himself mentally for this victory, visualized it with his dreams and all that, and his meditation or whatever else he did. And so when he arrived on stage, he was totally different than a lot of the competitors.
You know, the mind is a very powerful tool if you use it correctly.
Yeah.
And he would, as you said, he could create that aura of a winner. And not everybody could do that because not everybody, you know, would believe that they were a winner. And they would come into the contest and say, I have a chance.
Yeah.
He would come into a contest saying, I've won this contest. If I've prepared for it and I've won it, if I do everything I know that I have to do, my body is already there.
Yeah.
And it projected itself.
Yeah.
You see it. Plus, he'd already won the previous year and he was Mr. Olympia. And when you go into a contest that you have, you know, that you're already the champion, you have a little bit of a psychological leg up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I always felt like when I was going to see the Olympia, my attitude was like, I wonder if Zane's going to do it again. Because he wasn't a big guy, so he wasn't a dominant winner like Lee Haney was or some of the other guys later on, some of the really big guys. So you were always wondering, can he put it all together? And that's what Zane did. He put it all together. He was ripped. His posing trunks were perfect. His tan was perfect. His posing was perfect. And he really like willed himself almost to win those contests by doing everything correctly because he didn't have the size advantage that like Sergio had or Arnold or Lee Haney, you know.
You're exactly right. And and I guess you're going to get into it, but he needed to have that perfection going into 79 because 79 to me was a real, real challenge.
Yeah.
Mentzer came into that contest really, really. Good.
Yeah.
You look at the pictures. I mean, they're so different in their physiques. But again, Zane, I judged that contest. I like Mike. Zane did it again. And Zane did it again because he knew he was the winner and Mike was the challenger. And Mike in the pose down got carried away and just started throwing poses where Zane was calm, cool, and collected.
Yeah.
And on that stage in front of all those people, that's how you had to do to pretend yourself as the winner.
Right, right. Yeah, and it was different back then, too, because they had the under 200-pound class and the over 200-pound class. So Zane and Mike weren't compared at all until they got to the pose down at night. So that was something they changed the next year when they only had one class. But back then, it was kind of different with the two classes, too.
You know, Arnold said in 1980, according to print anyway, that him and Mike almost came to a physical confrontation that Arnold said, Mike, you know, we all know you lost last year because you're something to the effect that your stomach was.
Yes.
But I don't recall it that way at all. I think that Mike in 79, his abs looked really, really sharp.
Yeah.
Very muscular and sharp. He carried a lot more body weight than Zane did, and he was almost as sharp, but he didn't have the presentation or the those fine lines that Zane had.
Yeah.
He didn't win, but he was awfully close. I don't know what the final vote score was, but it was tight. Real tight.
Yeah, I think Mike was 20 pounds heavier, because one of the things I always liked, too, about your contest reports, Roger, was that, you know, this is, of course, when they were weighing them in, because they had a under 200, over 200-pound class. But you would always list their exact weight, which was really cool, because, you know, sometimes people will exaggerate. Years later, people will say they weighed this or whatever. But you had the exact weight, so here it is for posterity. And with Zane, let's see what he was.
Well, I could tell you he was about 190.
Yeah, 190.2, yeah. So you said here was the 1979 version of Zane, 5 pounds heavier at 190.2 pounds, tan and skin texture deeper and richer than ever, first impressions, definite fuller appearance in the quadriceps and upper arms. However, a slight strain in the abdominals where none appeared last year. These definite early conclusions, nobody in the under 200s was now that much bigger than Zane. Secondly, his abs, when flexed, were as sharp as ever. His total physique was, again, the most finished and popular with the audience. However, when relaxed, softer than 1978. Third, he was not the winner as soon as he walked on stage as he was last year. How the crowd loved him. I wondered if Zane had already projected himself as the winner. And then with Mensur, you said, Mike Mensur at his best. I still remember that line. I remember when I was a kid and I read this, and I still remember that. What a sight, 209.5 pounds of awesome muscle. Mensur had the look of a winner. The first notable improvement was the abdominals, a very deep, sharp line stretched from sternum to navel, no visible fat. That in itself would have been enough. However, from the back, Mensur was even more unbelievable when he was announced that over national television as a weak point is now the most thick cut-up back musculature around, with teres, infraspinatus, and lumbar visible and ripped. Frank Zane had a battle on his hands in the name of Mike Mensur.
I was right.
Yeah.
Contest. What a contest. And then Mike, if he had any chance at all, he blew it during the pose down.
Yeah, yeah.
We love it. He was learning at the time. But I'll tell you, as sharp as Mike was in 79, in the summer of 1980 when he was training with me, he was even sharper.
Yeah.
He always carried a trifle of what they would call water, but I think was subcutaneous fat right below his navel.
Okay.
In 1980, he had veins, and that where it used to be, that fat was veins. And he went to Sydney. Oh, my God, really ripped. But in Sydney, when I saw the pictures, his pecs didn't look as full as when I was training with him.
Yeah.
I tended to believe that was just the pictures that I was seeing. But other people have commented on it. And so, you know, I guess they were right. But I wasn't there. So yeah. 70 was the last time, or 80 in the summer was the last time I saw him. And he was, to me, unbeatable.
Yeah.
He was so unbeatable that he had projected himself that he was going to win in Sydney. He really thought he was going down there to win.
Yeah.
He didn't know Arnold was going to compete, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But he thought he could. He had read about Zane being lighter because of the accident, and he really thought Zane was his main competition. I don't think he realized how good Boyer Coe came in 1980.
Yeah.
Boyer Coe, oh, my God. I mean, he could be up and down.
Yeah.
When he was in, he was in calendar that year. Same thing.
Yeah.
Roger Walker, even. Same thing. Dennis Tenorino, who ever since he won the Teenage Mr. America way back in 65 or 66, he was overlooked for so many years. And this guy was tremendous. I mean, there was no weaknesses. Judges just weren't into his physique for some reason.
Yeah. Like this guy
didn't have a weak body part, did he? Not that I recall.
Maybe the back. The back wasn't as good as the front.
Yeah, maybe the back. But from the front, his abs were
Incredible, yeah. He was wide and tall, yeah.
Yeah, I think from the back, you're right, John. I think he didn't turn around as well as he was from the front.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mike was, you know, traveling to Australia. He might have flattened out a little bit. Who knows, you know. And I remember reading in Jack Neary's article in Muscle and Fitness that he said Mensah had turned his hotel room into a sauna, and he had closed all the windows and turned the heat up in the hotel room just to, you know, get rid of more water. So maybe he took it a little bit too far, a little bit flat, you know, like you said, with his chest.
Yeah, maybe.
One other guy I want to mention who was one of my favorites was Cal Skalak, and he was in the 78 Olympia. And let me see where you talk about him. Okay. Finally, Cal Skalak. When Cal first walked out, I said to myself, he's not going to win it. On first glance, his midsection was somewhat too smooth, and his legs, while improved, were not there with his gigantic shoulders, chest, and arms. It was only within seconds, however, when those instinctive feelings left. When Skalak starts his posing routine, his personality and the mood which he is able to create is electric. Look up the word charisma. This man has it. If he doesn't have the best physique in the world, he doesn't know it. He has the ability to excite an audience. He can present himself in so positive a way that you find yourself only seeing his strong points, never his weaknesses. By the conclusion of the prejudging, there were more than a few believing that in the conclusion, it would be Zane and Skalak. And I was at that show, and I agree with you. I mean, Cal, when he posed, the crowd was going crazy. I've got pictures from the little camera I had, and you can see people's arms up in the air, you know, in the audience, because they were all cheering for Cal. And I think a lot of people were even standing up for him.
Really, that's true. I saw him in Philadelphia win the Mr. AAU, Mr. America in 76.
Yeah.
He was a deserving winner, although a fellow by the name of Joe Means was
shredded
that day, but in one most muscular, but Cal deserved to win. And I had seen Cal train in Philadelphia years earlier. When he moved to California, he improved immensely. Hmm. And he was pale and white in Philadelphia, and he was rich and tan in California. And he knew how to take a crowd he gripped them, and he knew how to pose. And he, just like I said in the write-up, at the beginning you didn't see it, and by the end you thought he was the man.
Yeah.
And he almost was.
Yeah.
And then he became Jesus on the cross, and he,
yeah.
He ended the contest. He put his head down and crucified, but I didn't buy it. I mean, I think he probably placed where he deserved that night. He was an awfully great physique, but he was competing against awfully great physiques.
Yeah, you said what happened next was unforgettable. Fifth place, Kalman Skalak. The catcalls and booing filled the auditorium. Skalak stood shaking his head in disbelief. The boos turned instantly to cheers when Skalak flashed a double biceps, immediately followed by a most muscular. With the noise at a crescendo, the unforgettable Skalak, feet crossed, head tilted, arms stretched wide, eyes closed as if he were letting the loud voices know that this was been his crucifixion. In the seconds following, as the others awaited their places, he left the stage. How this scene will be handled by the media will be known sooner or later. In reflection, there will be those who were there and definitely more who were not there, whose conditioned reflex will be to immediately condemn Skalak's actions. The opposing spectrum of thought, however, will see Skalak's actions as a creative momentary response to his demise this evening. Yeah, it was creative.
Stand by those words.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so great that you did these articles because you were there, you saw it, you recorded it, you got the weights, like I said, and it's such a big difference when you're there and you record it right after, right? So you remember everything that happened on stage, and then it's there for history, you know? Yeah, those were some great days, right, Roger?
Yes, sir.
All right, Roger. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. It was great seeing you. I haven't talked to you in, like I said, a few years. So I love the fact that these articles are still with us, if you're still lucky enough to have the magazines. And they really are part of history. And I'm glad you were there. And I appreciate you joining me again so we could talk about those old days of bodybuilding, which I'll never forget.
I will always be there for you, John. I respect you. I respect your great career. I respect that you're still training hard these days. And
thank you.
You're still at it. So, you know, you're a voice now in the industry. Let it be heard.
Yeah. Thank you, Roger. I appreciate it. And if I'm ever out in Philadelphia, I'll look you up and
we can be there.
Have a workout or work a dinner or something.
Always.
Okay. All right, Roger. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon again, hopefully.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to my friend Roger Schwab for joining us for that interview. It's always great to talk to Roger, and it's been 2 years since I talked to him, so it was great catching up with him. Thank you also to all our Patreon sponsors for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I could not do the show without you guys, so thank you for contributing to the show and helping with our production costs. If you are interested in being a sponsor, a Patreon sponsor yourself, you can just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. The link is on the bottom here in our description. And you can become a Patreon donor yourself by just clicking on the upper right-hand corner. You'll see the link for Patreon. Also, if you're interested in online training, I am still working with Pro Physique, and I am doing online workouts and diet plans. So if you're interested in that, the link is also listed below. I would love to help out any of you guys if you're interested in shaping up and getting a new workout and diet program. It's very easy to do it online. All right, before we let you guys go, I want to read this article called Zane Wins Mr. Olympia. It is from the January 1979 issue of Iron Man magazine, and it is the 1978 Mr. Olympia contest report. It was several moments past 3:30 on this Saturday afternoon when an announcer, Len Boslin, spoke to the anxious, overflowed audience. Ladies and gentlemen, the lightweight contestants in the 1978 IFBB Mr. Olympia contest. It is my gut feeling that within seconds of that announcement, an overwhelming percentage of onlookers realized simultaneously that Frank Zane had defended his title spectacularly. Zane was first to appear in the lineup, and it seemed endless seconds before the rest of the class followed him onto the stage. Zane nearly swept across the stage as if he were the only contestant. It was immediately evident that he was totally secure with his preparation. Realizing that he was near or at total perfection of his development, Zane had seemingly already mentally projected himself as the winner. This inner projection somehow seemed to grip the emotions of the onlookers. Alone on stage, Zane faced the audience standing relaxed, internally charged. He was so symmetrical, refined to a point. His abdominals, always conspicuous, were better than ever, and the whole appearance was enhanced by the richest skin coloring imaginable. Lest this article escape its scope and centers only on the Zane mystique, let's reflect upon the competition commencing with the afternoon prejudging. There were seven challengers to Zane in the under 200-pound class, and Boyer Coe led the lineup that followed him onto the stage. The immediate audience reaction was that Coe was in superb condition, the best of his career. Boyer appeared massive and muscular, much sharper than in previous appearances this year. He weighed in at 190 pounds, several pounds lighter than in past contests. The loud approval from the audience had its impact on Boyer, and he probably knew that he would be right up there with the finalists. It is personally noted here that the Coe physique may be equated as the antithesis of Zane's physique. This comparison probably hurts Coe in the lineup. Though he appears 20 pounds larger than Frank, the size is overshadowed by Zane's sharper lines. Mohammed Makawe had not been seen by most of the audience since his spectacular win here last year in the Mr. International competition. During the prejudging, his physique did not exhibit the detail of a year ago, nor did Mohammed generate the hyper stage presentation of which he is capable. Later, under the warmth of the evening spotlight, he appeared much more muscular. Overall, this was a disappointing performance from Makawe. Coming out of Egypt these past several years into international competition had created great anticipation of the Makawe physique. Now the sharp edge has dulled somewhat. One senses that there is another chapter left to come in his story. We shall see. Next in the prejudging lineup appeared Albert Beckles, who unfortunately we see only once a year. Time has done little to detract from Beckles' powerful build. Yet he is somewhat older than most of the competitors, and this year was somewhat smoother in the torso than previously. The density of muscle remains, and the highest peak biceps will always be his. Though the coveted Mr. Olympia title will probably evade his grasp, Beckles has left his mark on the international physique scene and has lent a little class wherever he has traveled. In each report of a major competition, Ed Corney is a story in himself. Since the time, several years ago, when Corney separated himself from all other competitors with his innovating posing routine, he has been the house favorite. Standing relaxed in the lineup, Corney was impressive, very impressive. At 44, he has the tendency to look heavy, especially in the midsection and lower back areas. This aspect is usually overlooked during the posing routine, which totally captivates an audience and makes Corny nearly appear invincible, impregnable to weaknesses. Overall competition is, however, not limited to posing. An evening audience, of course, only views the posing routine, which partly explains why when Corny does not win a contest, there are literally near riots. This year, there was little or no heaviness, and Corny, to my eye, anyway, would be right near the top, challenging all the way. Danny Padilla entered his first Mr. Olympia at around 162 pounds, reiterating what has been stated endlessly. Danny, when he gets it all together, will be the ultimate giant killer. The question echoes, when he gets it all together. It seems that even at varying body weights, Danny is just a shade away from the degree of muscularity he needs to reach his pinnacle, his full potential. Today was not an exception. Though every body part blended together and he possessed the finest shape of muscle and symmetry in the entire event, the hard, sharp definition of muscle was still not quite there. Tony Emmett, in his first IFBB event, wasted no time in establishing himself as a favorite. This is a quality physique with no apparent weaknesses. Standing relaxed on a lineup or going through a polished posing display, this man is a pro. There are no overwhelming body parts, with the exception of a wide and muscular back. Everything just seems to fit together in an unusual blend of symmetry and style. If there is any criticism, it might be a more dynamic personality or presentation on stage is needed to create the impact that is deserving of this fine physique. The final under 200-pound competitor was Bill Grant. The added 5 or so pounds to the Grant physique did not detract from the most detailed midsection in the contest. It is still surprising that those huge arms and overall muscularity still give way to the critical abuse offered about Grant's lack of leg, especially calf size. Grant possesses some very long muscle bellies in his upper arms and some very short muscle bellies in his calves. This is a hereditary factor, not subject to change. Whether or not Grant ever wins or places near the top of this major competition, he should be appreciated as a world-class physique. He today reacted somewhat bewildered by the audience's critical reception and never really seemed to get it going. A positive PR program by some of the magazines depicting Grant as the sensitive guy he really is would probably enhance his image to this contest crowds immediately. The first over 200-pound competitor was Robbie Robinson. In a previous report, I mentioned that if Robbie appeared at the Olympia as sharp as he did on May 6th at the Night of the Champions, he would be the 1978 Mr. Olympia. Such, however, was not the case. Robbie was again too smooth. He looked today still 10 pounds heavier than needed. Great roundness of muscle and Herculean size, to be sure, but without that final touch of refinement, which he showed clearly in May in his finest hour. Though Robbie was the pre-contest favorite again this year, I guess that this evening's verdict would duplicate last year's heartbreaking loss. Roy Callender is improving with every competition. Standing in the lineup, he takes a back seat to no one. His upper body is massive and tremendously defined for so big a man. When and if his legs reach the maturity of his upper body, he will probably win this contest. His posing routine needs some work, but he has all the tools to be a winner, a big winner. Dennis Tinerino looked muscular and ready. He was the 1967 Mr. America and was better today 11 years later. Dennis has wide shoulders and fine abdominals. He looks and acts confident on stage, like a winner. Some felt that his upper back could be more developed and thicker. Whatever, it was good seeing him in such remarkable shape, holding his own in his highest competition. Perhaps the most improved physique over the past year was that of Roger Walker. At last year's Olympia, Walker was flat, probably not ready for this event. This year, he was improved significantly, with a much deeper tan, which enhanced a well-muscled physique. Roger was a positive force in the lineup. If he shows continued improvement over the next year, he will be reckoned with. Finally, Cal Scalath. When Cal first walked out, I said to myself, he's not going to win it. On first glance, his midsection was somewhat too smooth, and his legs, while improved, were not there with his gigantic shoulders, chest, and arms. It was only within seconds, however, when those instinctive feelings left. When Scalath starts his posing routine, his personality and the mood which he is able to create is electric. Look up the word charisma. This man has it. If he doesn't have the best physique in the world, he doesn't know it. He has the ability to excite an audience. He can present himself in so positive a way that you find yourself only seeing his strong points, never his weaknesses. By the conclusion of prejudging, there were more than a few believing that in the conclusion, it would be Zane and Skalak. When each competitor completed his posing routine at the evening show itself, the top six finalists were named. The six, in no particular order, were Zane, Coe, Padilla, Robinson, Callender, and Skalak. The final pose-off was exciting, however, not quite the intensity of a year ago. Missing from the final six were such names as Corny, Emmett, and Tinerino, who had their faithful in the audience in silence. In Corny's case, it was to some downright hearsay. I felt a little empty watching that final pose-down without the familiar sight of Corny turning on the whole house. Whatever, when Danny Padilla was announced for sixth place, there were no complaints. Danny had done well in his first Olympia. Next year might fully tell his tale. What happened next was unforgettable. Fifth place, Kelman Skalak. The catcalls and booing filled the auditorium. Skalak stood shaking his head in disbelief. The boos turned instantly into cheers when Skalak flashed a double biceps, immediately followed by a most muscular pose. With a noise at a crescendo, the unforgettable Skalak, feet crossed, head tilted, arms stretched wide, eyes closed as if he was letting the loud voices know that this had been his crucifixion. In the seconds following, as the others awaited their places, he left the stage. How this scene will be handled by the media will be known sooner or later. In reflection, there will be those who were there and definitely more who were not there, whose conditioned reflex will be immediately to condemn Skalak's actions. The opposing spectrum of thought, however, will see Skalak's actions as a creative momentary response to his demise this evening. Back to the final announcements. Boyer Coe's fourth place finish duplicated the results of a year ago. The placement was, however, the only duplication. This was a new Coe, silencing the small but vocal critics who sensed that his best days were behind him. Several seasoned judges confident to this reporter later told me that Coe had received their second place votes. Roy Callender stated to me after the contest, placing third behind Zane and Robbie is no disgrace. I agree. Reassuring him to realize that he has the guns to win, not place. Robbie and Zane were the final two as they were 1 year ago. I felt that Robinson, as he stood there, might be counting the final moments until Zane was announced the winner. There seemed to be no sense of surprise when his thoughts became reality. He hugged Zane, the winner, and held up his hand. The seconds must have been hours to Robbie, but he handled it like the man that he is. Frank Zane is Mr. Olympia in 1978. He deserved it. Just a quick anecdote, West Coast officials said to me several weeks prior to this contest that Zane couldn't win this year and did not deserve to win last year. The fact that this official did not attend either year is not surprising. Zane tonight was a winner, a very unbelievable winner. Bill Pearl and Larry Scott gave posing exhibitions which deserve much more space than I am allotted. What a thrill to see these two great bodybuilders of the early 60s approaching their championship form. This might have been Pearl's farewell performance, and he was greeted by a standing ovation. I have a feeling we will see Scott again, even better on a winner's dais. He, too, received a long standing ovation. In the preliminary event, Joe Nazario triumphed over Carlos Rodriguez and Roger Callard and the balance of the field for the Mr. International event. My opinion is that a Mr. Olympia competition doesn't need a second event on the card. Hopefully in the future, the Olympia event will be contested alone on a separate day, which it deserves. So the final placings, Mr. Olympia, Frank Zane first, Robbie Robinson second, Roy Callender third, Boyer Coe fourth, Kelman Skalak fifth, Danny Padilla sixth, and others in alphabetical order were Albert Beckles, Ed Corny, Tony Emmett, Bill Grant, Mohammed Makawe, Dennis Tinerino, and Roger Walker. And then in the Mr. International, in the lightweight class, Carlos Rodriguez was first, Tony Pandolfo second, John Burkholder third. In the middleweight class, Roger Callard was first, Samir Benoit was second, and Frank Colta from Tampa, Florida was third. And then in the heavyweight class, Joe Nazario was first, Ben Herder was second, and Ray Menser, Mike Menser's brother, was third, and the overall went to Joe Nazario. All right, great article by Roger Schwab. I love how he talked about every single competitor. Sometimes he would even mention their weights because they had a weigh-in because they had an over 200-pound class. So Roger would sometimes put in their official weights, which was awesome. And I totally agreed with Ed Corny's placing. I thought Ed should have been in the top six. I thought Ed was in fantastic shape that year. And his posing routine was really innovative. It was different than 1977, but he really tried some different stuff and the crowd absolutely loved him. And I thought he was in great shape compared to 77. He was bigger, much bigger. And I thought he was in great shape. I thought he should have beat Danny Padilla, who, as Roger mentioned, was in his first Olympia. And Roger mentioned that if Danny ever comes in shape, which he did come in shape 3 years later, 1981, but he was kind of ripped off with that fifth place finish at the 81 Olympia. And I also like that he mentioned Boyer Coe because Boyer was fantastic at every one of the Mr. Olympias that I saw. And he was one of the few guys that improved every year. He was good in 77. He was much better in 78. And he was even better in 79. And the fact that Boyer only weighed 190 pounds, that's amazing. And then, of course, Cal Skalak had to be there to see Cal because Roger says in the article, Cal really had that charisma. And when he came out and posed, the audience just loved him. I mean, there were people standing up after he got done doing his posing routine at the morning. And back then, they would do the posing routine in the morning and at night. But at night, I believe they would do it to – no, they didn't have music back then. They didn't have music until 1980. So there was no music. But they would do the posing routine at both, in the morning and at night. And Robbie, I thought, was in fantastic shape, much better than the year before, 1977, when he was holding water. And he was in much, much better shape and could have went either way. But Zane really did look fantastic. I remember in 1978, Zane had reached like a new level of muscularity. He was so much more ripped than everybody else. And as Roger said, the moment he walked out, it was like he was the winner. And what's interesting is that Zane was actually lighter in 1978 than he was in 1977. In 1977, I believe Zane weighed 185 pounds. In this contest in 1978, he was 182 pounds. He was 3 pounds lighter because Frank said, and I read this in his book, that when he saw the pictures from 1977, he was disappointed. And he thought he looked bigger, but he felt like he was more ripped in 76 when he took second to Franco. So he resolved that when he came back in 78, he would be really, really ripped and had that same muscularity that he had when he took second to Franco. And as a result, he was 3 pounds lighter. And that's interesting when we had our talk with Lee Haney and Rich Gaspari and Sameer Banute last week, and we were talking about how you don't need to be bigger to be better. And Lee Haney also did the same thing. I believe Lee was 243 when he won the title first in 1984. And then when he competed in 1985, a year later in Belgium, Lee was actually a couple pounds lighter. I believe it was like 241. And for the same reason, Lee felt that he could have been better than he was in 84 by becoming in more muscular and more ripped. So that is it for our show this week, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking to Roger Schwab. So thank you again to him for coming out here and talking to us again and being on the show. Next week, we are going to be talking to two Mr. America and Mr. Universe winners from the AAU and from NABBA. We've got Matt Dufresne, who was the 1989 AAU Mr. America and also the NABBA Mr. Universe winner that year. And we've got the great Jeff King joining us next week with Matt. And Jeff, of course, was the 1983 Mr. America and also Mr. Universe. So we got Matt and Jeff on the show next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Until then, guys, train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you next week. Take care.